I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax News listeners. On this edition of the program, we're doing the Afghanistan blunder boogie. Now, listen, I don't actually like to make jokes about the 20 years and trillions of dollars as well as human lives spent in the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, but I feel like our guest has a bit more of a sense of humor about it, maybe a bit darker sense of humor about it. He is the libertarian gadfly Jim Bovard, author of such books as The Bush Betrayal, Attention Deficit Democracy, and Public Policy Hooligan. And I felt like some boogie-woogie music was fair game, given the nature of our conversation, which is peppered with some dark humor that is necessary in these times, I think, at least, because, well, hell, if you don't laugh, you'll cry. That being said, it's a very serious conversation as Jim and I discuss his article, Washington Arrogance is Incurable, available now for reading at Counterpunch. That's counterpunch.org if you want to check it out. Anyways, this is a very serious conversation, again, peppered with some of Jim's trademark humor. We discuss a number of topics, including that aforementioned article and much, much more in this jam-packed, almost hour-long conversation. So I hope you enjoy it. And with that being said, let's get right to it with Jim Bovard, the libertarian gadfly. Welcome back to Parallax Views. A guest that I've come to enjoy having on, have had him on once before, less than a month ago, but decided, well, I need to have him on again because he has a bunch of articles coming out on the situation in Afghanistan, which, you know, we have officially evacuated. Our U.S. troops are out. And I am talking about the one and only public policy hooligan, James Bovard. Should I say Jim or James?
Either. Jim is fine. I mean, it's a podcast, so it's Jim. If it's PBS, it'd be James.
So, Jim, I wanted to have you on to talk about these articles that you're writing about Afghanistan. And the one that I found that I believe was recently carried at Counterpunch was about your experience with, you know, what I would call one of these DC blob or blobsters, as Doug Bondow refers to them. Tell my listeners a little bit about that article. There, that felt like a really strong piece that gave an insight into how a lot of these sort of DC bureaucrat types think.
Yeah, well, it was a, you know, I've enjoyed hiking basically forever. And about 8-9 years ago, I was joining a group for a winter hike down by Great Falls National Park in Maryland. So I'm standing, it was a, you know, wasn't too cold that day. I was just kind of standing around leaning on a rail fence before the hike started, and a handicap van pulled up to the side of the nearby road. A 20-something woman comes bounding out of the shotgun seat. She zips around to the side. She had long brown hair pulled back, single ponytail, caught by a St. Louis Cardinals baseball hat. That was a perfect hat to complement a bit of rose she had. She slid open that side door of the handicap van. Her husband poked his head out warily. Dude had a sturdy jaw, looked like Hollywood caliber good looks, military style haircut, and an Army Ranger t-shirt. She stretched up to provide him a slight assist as he moved gingerly out of the van like a toddler taking his first steps. He had one shirt sleeve cut off instead of a left arm, he had a metal rod protruding with a wire hand at the end. As he exited that van, I noticed in place of legs, he had two metal rods going down from his knees. That soldier was clenching a monogram wooden cane in his right hand while his wife by his left side eased him forward. And she had such a radiant smile. It was one of the things that stuck in my memory from that day. Maybe this was the day that she'd been waiting for ever since she got the bad news from the other side of the world. That couple was trying to recapture a little bit of normalcy and the joys they feared they lost forever. Her husband was probably maimed by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan. This was during Obama's surge to Afghanistan to bring them democracy. So I don't know how long that guy had been rehab, how much progress he'd made. Walter Reed Hospital is not very far from that hiking venue. And it's, you know, I've seen couples like that on the National Mall at the National Zoo, where their wives or girlfriends supporting their, you know, handicapped mates at this point. So, and it was just, you know, it wasn't something I was expecting. And it was chilling because it brings home, yeah, this is the war. And it's not just on the other side of the world. And it's people getting whacked, you know, ruined for life. Families ruined for life. So I was, as I was waiting, this chunky blue-eyed blonde comes up. She recognized me from earlier hikes. She plumps down on the rail fence next to me. She boasted about having a hangover and made her look 40s before her time. She was dressed very fancy, bright green down vest, a very sharp running outfit, latest chic running shoes. I, on the hand, was dressed with a barn coat and an old beat up battered Aussie style canvas hat. So I didn't look like the sharpest knife in the drawer, and that probably helped the following conversation. So she started talking about how she was about the you know, all the exercise feats she does. This is something typical in DC hikes. People brag about they've done this, they've done that. And so she asked me if I'd ever run a marathon. I said, well, no, but I was on the 880 relay team in high school. And she just kind of sneered at me like I was the biggest loser she'd met all year. And then she started telling me about her career. She told me that when she applied for grad school for her MBA, she says, my GMAT scores were very impressive. And she said that a second time. So I wondered if she'd gotten those scores tattooed on her left area. I didn't want to check. But so she goes on, and then she transcended that triumph by becoming a foreign service officer. Now, there's a certain cachet that these foreign service officers have in D.C. They're the kind of folks who have great respect for each other, and they act like they're like a caste, like they're a Brahmin caste that makes policy. So she starts talking about the stuff she'd done. She talks about how she'd been at embassies in South America for 10 years, and she was there to help defend the drug war. So I was thinking, how many innocent peasants did you apologize for killing? But, you know, I didn't push that point.
Was there, not to interrupt you, but was there sort of, did you sense a sort of, I was talking to retired Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kwiatkowski recently.
Karen is great. Karen's a Virginian.
What she said to me was, with her experience in the Pentagon, the one thing that she got out of interacting with a lot of these neocons and war hawks was that they really have a contempt for just average people. Did you sort of get that sense in a way with her? Or?
Very much, very much. I mean, she was, and, you know, I was surprised she talked to me as long as she did. I think she had disdain for most of the people who she met and most of the people who she, you know, helped govern. She started talking about how the State Department was basically the wisest of all federal agents. Feel free to interrupt me here. That's because I'm going on this story here. But anyhow, she talked about the State Department being so wise. She says that other agencies weren't as good because they couldn't find ways to elevate the best and the brightest to the top, kind of like the State Department did. And it was obvious because she was up there at the top. So I said, what about Americans who say the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was the biggest blunder since the Vietnam War? She says, it's unclear whether invading Iraq was a bad idea. And she kind of sniffs, turns her nose up. Saddam Hussein was an evil ruler. There's a lot of inside information that has not been made public that would put the Bush administration's decision in a very different light. So I said, didn't bipartisan congressional investigations conclude that the Bush team blundered massively, lied to the American people? Heather, this woman, she scoffs. There are a lot of facts that Congress didn't know. You can't rely on their conclusions. So basically, here's a woman who's acting like she's got exclusive access to the Temple of Delphi, or at least the bureaucratic equivalent of the Temple of Delphi. And so, you know, I was sticking with my, you know, harmless country boys thing. I said, so what do you think about WikiLeaks? You know, because this is just after WikiLeaks dumped thousands of secret State Department cables, and they showed how Hillary Clinton was still Secretary of State. Hillary Clinton was stealing credit card numbers of the United Nations and stuff like that, and a huge number of atrocities in Afghanistan and Iraq. And she snorted. She says, I've not looked at any of those cables. We were told we would lose our security clearance if we read any of those unauthorized disclosures. Since the information had not been officially disclosed, good Washingtonians were obliged to pretend it did not exist. So she got
the talking points down entirely.
Oh, it was funny. I mean, that was part of the charm of the conversation. That's why as soon as I was done with the hype, I grabbed my pen and my notebook, a little spiral notebook, and just, okay, to try to get as verbatim as possible. So, and then she's, I mentioned at some point in passing that, I'm a journalist. It didn't hold her attention. She was enjoying spreading her expertise, and that was fine by me. And then she starts going the shtick. She says, private citizens cannot make competent criticisms of U.S. foreign policy. She says, even if you study the relationship between the U.S. and another country, the whole time you would only know it at most 80% of the most important facts. It's like trying to judge a married couple who you casually know. It's simply not possible to do. So, and since Heather was between the sheets of U.S. foreign policy, I should take her word that Americans weren't getting screwed. And then she goes on this shtick. She says, if you want to deal with unadulterated mass stupidity, just look at the opinion polls on foreign aid. Almost everybody's against it, but they don't even know how much money the U.S. government donates abroad. Even worse, people fail to recognize how the aid, how that aid advances America's grand strategic objectives. So I says, haven't there been some controversies about the aid bankrolling atrocities by foreign governments? She says, U.S. has no responsibility for the actions of foreign governments that receive U.S. foreign aid. They are separate entities. It's like responsible adults. They do their own thing. So I was kind of silently, muttering to myself, it's too bad the U.S. government never gave me $1 billion to do my own thing. I've been writing about foreign aid for decades at that point, but I could never recall the program being vindicated before as a subsidy for foreign politicians' self-expression. So I say, so help me figure this out. Any American who donates to a foreign group that commits atrocities can get charged with material support of terrorism. Why isn't the same standard used for the recipients of U.S. foreign aid? She says, it's different when our government does it because then it's in the national interest. I mean, I said, like, ooh, I said, well, how do we know that? She gives me this look like the kind of look a schoolmarm would give to the dumbest kid in the class. That's why we have a democracy. There are checks and balances. So I says, well, how can we have self-government if the feds are withholding so much information from citizens? She says, people know what they need to know. I mean, she's kind of Nixonian at this point. So people don't need to be told everything because the people in charge are experts. Besides, sometimes it's more important for the government to do what's right, not just what's popular. She was almost at the point of saying that the State Department is doing God's work or doing what God would do if he knew the facts of the matter.
I was going to say, how can you possibly debate someone like this? It seems like they've sort of created their own sort of a world where you can't really question them. They'll just say, well, you know, we just need to do this because, you know, we need secrecy and you people don't know what you're talking about, you plebs.
Well, yeah, I mean, she had her catechism. She had her foreign policy catechism, and she was used to responding to people who would be intimidated by her and would instinctively defer to her claimed expertise. I mean, I've been writing about this crap for decades, so it's kind of like, you know, I didn't need to make that clear to her, but, you know, I just kept drawing her out. So, you know, so I says, so if the government is, yeah, if the government's so secretive, then she says, well, Americans are free because they can vote. Everybody knows that. She's getting snappy at this point. So I say, you know, I sense her patience was almost done. I asked if she felt any personal responsibility for promoting policies that worked out badly for the U.S. or foreigners. She says, I have to be an adult, and being an adult means taking responsibility. It's like proposing a budget. Sometimes you don't have control of all the items in your budget, and not all the numbers are met, but you have to take responsibility. She knew all the rhetorical tricks to absolve the government. So I says, so how does that apply to cases where the U.S. bombs foreign nations and unleashes mass killing and chaos like in Libya? She growls and looks at me disgusted. She says, you know, I should not even be talking to you. And I just gave her a Cheshire Cat smile, and she stomped off. And I said, okay, end of conversation. But she's a fascinating woman. She was very intelligent, but her career progress hinged on her having zero intellectual curiosity. She only read official sources, so she knew that the officials were wonderful. Talking like her was arguing with some cult figure from a religion who simply knew the memorized answers and almost always gets away with them. But she didn't do that with me.
I'm sorry,
go ahead.
Not to interrupt you, but no. What's so crazy about this exchange that you write about with her is that, you know, in the background of it, you have troops around that look like they're just in distress. They've suffered because of these wars. And that seems to be a complete afterthought to her.
Oh, no, it wasn't an afterthought. It didn't show up on her radar. There was the last riff in the article was that, there was a second handicap van that pulled up as I was going back to my car. A reddish curly haired lass pops out, helps her partner out. And he was missing one leg and he was not doing well. He was struggling, you know, neither one of them had a smile. But the Heather, the State Department lady, she was long gone, but she wouldn't have given them a second glance because she would assume that none of those maimed soldiers could have passed the Foreign Service Officer's exam. So because of that, I mean, it's a really toxic thing when you have, this self-canonized elite who think that they're so smart that they are above the facts and also above any duty for candor. No sense of remorse at all for any U.S. government fiascos. And by 2012, the U.S. government, you know, the war on terror had been going on for more than 10 years. It was a fiasco in Syria, in Somalia, in Yemen, in Afghanistan, in Iraq, other places. A torture regime had been unleashed, started by Bush and covered up by Obama. There were so many atrocities which the U.S. government had fomented by that point. But, you know, there was that sense of moral superiority. And every now and then I run into someone who is such a pure example of that it's comical in a very dark way.
What gets me about it is, you know, it seems like these sort of figures, or figures like, and we'll get to this, but Max Boot or like a Robert Kagan, I look at them and I see people that will fight with every last drop of blood shed by some kids in, you know, for me in Pennsylvania, in places like Greenville, PA, where a lot of kids, to get out of their small town, they join the military, right? They'll fight with every last drop of their blood, but I don't see Robert Kagan sending his kids off to the wars. And it really actually gets my goat.
Yeah, well, there was justifiably, there was a great quote about Senator Joe Lieberman. Someone said that the only war he ever opposed was the one he would have had to fight in Vietnam. And it's fascinating to see the editorial pages, the op-ed pages, to see a lot of these warmongers, neoconservatives and others, with these, absolving themselves for the absolute fiasco of Afghanistan and other places. There's so much smugness. But, you know, the State Department lady, she wasn't unique. I met quite a few people at DC, on hikes and in D.C. receptions who have that swagger. And it's funny because, you know, they think they're invincible. But if they're perceptive, you ask them a few questions and all of a sudden the bubble starts, the air starts to fizzle out of their balloon. And they're kind of thinking like, get me out of this freaking conversation. I mean, it's very rare for me to make a direct attack on somebody. I didn't do it for this woman on the hike. But it's like, so tell me more. Well, how does this work? And how does that work? So,
well, what's really weird to me about it, and I always tell people this, I don't think these sort of bureaucrats even necessarily have, for lack of a better word, ill intentions. But as Stephen Walt, the Quincy Institute told me once, it's the hell of good intentions. I mean, these people really think they are on the right side to the point where if you question them at all, you know, they can't take it.
Well, yeah. And there's also a presumption that you're inferior. I mean, that's something which came out early in the conversation with this lady on the hike. Is it like, well, how many marathons have you run? Have you done this? Have you done that? Well, I mean, there's a shitload of physical things I've done, but I don't need to list it because it's like, that was in the last century. So
I was going to say she probably wouldn't like me because I'm a smoker.
I'm sitting here chewing on my cheap cigar. Well, she'd have lots of reasons to dislike you. I mean, and first and foremost, because you didn't put her on a pedestal. But it's funny sometimes when you get people going, and it's fun to try to keep them talking because they're just digging deeper and they don't realize it. And they just figure, well, here's some dumbass who doesn't appreciate me. Here's someone who probably never went to grad school like me. I don't think I mentioned where I'm a college dropout, but, you know, I mean, I don't know. You know, it doesn't matter, you know.
So getting into the response that we've seen now that we have withdrawn from Afghanistan, what do you make of these figures that are just yelling at the top of their lungs like the end of the world has occurred? In particular, I know you wanted to say a few things about Max Boot, and I sort of wanted to say a few things about Max Boot because I still cannot believe that's his real name. I'm like, that's just too good. Max Boot. I'm like, is that a reference to the Orwell line about, you know, imagine a boot stamping on a human face
that's
forever?
I hadn't thought about it. I'm fairly sure he was born in Russia, so Russian immigrant. He was someone who I dealt with when he was an editorial page, one of the editorial page of editorial features editors at Wall Street Journal. And there was a story which he was adding, I think, in late 1996. And it was about a law that had just been passed to make it more difficult for females to get guns to defend themselves. And, you know, I'm big on the Second Amendment. And so he was just editing this piece, and we were talking on the phone. And I mean, it was so long ago that editors actually talked to writers on the phone. I mean, you know, you talk about Stone Age. It doesn't happen. Rarely happens nowadays. Anyhow, so we're just kind of chatting, and he was kind of, he seemed a little nervous about my story. And, you know, at some point he says, well, how many guns do you have? And I said, well, you know, I got a few. I mean, not too many. But he, you know, I guess it's all that voice level. I think he's actually, he was raised in California, went to UC Berkeley. And it's funny because he was editorial features editor in the late 90s. Didn't like my stuff. Not that I'm biased. But it's funny that he went from there, and I think he joined the Council of Foreign Relations from there, as have one or two other editorial features editors. And then I was kind of puzzled by that because does he know anything about foreign relations? And basically what he did was just advocate war and, you know, just endlessly, you know, pounding the drum. And that made him very popular. So it's sad to see how the pundits, The pundit system, the editorial pages, it's like there's a hold harmless standard for anyone who advocates a foreign war. Well, you know, the person might have been totally wrong and the war might have worked out bad, but they meant well. But I'm thinking, when is bombing and killing good intentions? But this is how it's scored in the Northeast Corridor. So
it's funny, too. I wanted to note, because I've always said this, and this is like a side note, we don't have to get into it, but I've always told people when it comes to, gun rights, I'm pretty far to the left. I agree with Bernie Sanders on a lot of stuff, Medicare for all and stuff like that. But, it's weird. People view me askance whenever I say, I'm for gun rights, even though I have all these sort of leftist views. I'm not sure that gun rights is inherently a left-right issue. I mean, there's leftist gun groups like the John Brown Gun Club. And I'm surprised that people, it's like they want to put you in a box and say, well, if you believe in X, then you're not Y, which is, it gets really ridiculous at a point.
I agree completely. It was especially paradoxical during the Trump administration, because you had all these people who were saying that Trump was a fascist, he was a dictator, and it's important for the government to take away our guns. So I'm kind of thinking, this is, I didn't see how that followed. Leftists have been horrendously persecuted in many places in the world once the government disarmed them. People on the left and the right have got the same reason to distrust arbitrary government power. So
I wanted to say, you have an article coming out soon, I think, with a really great title, Bitter Belated Afghanistan Vindication. Why that title? You have a way with words, my man.
Well, thanks. I was going back and pulling together a number of the articles that I've written over the last almost 20 years on Afghanistan. And it's like, I was calling bullshit, shortly after it started. And I was always opposed to the U.S. occupying Afghanistan. I was in favor of whacking the terrorist group that had done 9/11. But, that doesn't mean occupying this huge nation on the other side of the world. And it's just kind of the signs that it was going to be a fiasco were obvious early on. There were so many brazen lies. There was, basically, I think it was 3 days after 9/11 that George Bush promised to rid the world of evil. And at that point, I was thinking, man, we are screwed. Because, I guess Bush was going to rid the world of all the evil except that by politicians and governments, because that was who he unleashed. Bush had a line in October 2001. He said, as long as anybody's terrorizing established governments, there's got to be a war. And my view is that most of the governments in the world are oppressive and deserve to be overthrown. Certainly not all of them. As soon as you're just taking that, seeing any vigorous resistance to government as terrorism, then it's like it's like V for Vendetta, like the movie. It's like, turns everything into a nightmare.
I was going to add to that. I mean, for me, it was such a, I didn't really like, the Trump presidency that much at all, but people thought that was bad. And I'm like, you guys don't remember, especially young ones, don't remember how bad the Bush era was. I mean, he had that line, right? George W. Bush would say, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. And it was hard to speak out. You were treated as public enemy number one if you spoke out during the early days of the war on terror. And what's really amazing to me is I think we pissed away a lot of diplomatic goodwill after 9/11. At Iran right after 9/11, you had people in Iran saying this is horrible, what has happened to America. And then what does Bush do? He comes out and talks about the axis of evil. We can't deal with Iran and North Korea and this country and Iraq. And what did it all do for us? All it did was make other countries more afraid of us. It made diplomatic relations with those countries more difficult. It made war more inevitable in so many ways.
Yeah, and Bush was chomping at the bit to go to war with Iran, as was Trump. So that was one of the things. I was very critical of the Obama administration, but one thing that, to their credit, is that they avoided the push to go to war with Iran. So no, George W. Bush, I mean, it's just, it's appalling to me to see a lot of liberals, you know, putting a halo over him. Well, he was a good Republican. It's like, no, don't give me this crap. Look at what he said. Look at what he did. Worldwide torture regime, unleashing the NSA, unleashing the FBI, trampling the Constitution.
And now he's all over our television sets talking about, oh, the withdrawal was such a horrible idea. Why would you do this, Joe Biden? Thinking to myself, who are you? Who are you, George W. Bush? Like, you got us into this mess.
Yeah, I mean, and Bush is doing this, doing this routine concern about women's rights and all this stuff. And it's like, you know, Bush put Karzai in power in Afghanistan. Karzai signed a law that entitled husbands to starve their wives to death if their wives would not give their husbands sex. And I mean, this is, you know, this is too, no, I was going to make a joke, but I shouldn't. But this is so damn extreme. And any government, so, you know, I don't care if it's democratic or not. When you have that kind of law, it's a barbaric government. When you're authorizing this type of killing, well, you know, she didn't put out. So, all right, kill her. It's like, so you get a death sentence for saying no on Tuesday night? I mean, it's crazy. But this is, these are the hard facts, and they are simply ignored by, you know, 90% of the media that's like, well, you know, George W. Bush cared about women's rights. It's like, if you know, there was a line I wrote about this a few months ago, and it was talking about how George W. Bush really wasn't paying attention to the damn war. I think it was in late 2002. They were getting ready, wrapping up to invade Iraq, and the U.S. commander in Afghanistan was in Washington or in the Pentagon, and Rumsfeld asked Bush if he wanted to meet the guy. And Bush says, no, I don't need to meet him. So, or maybe Bush did not even know the guy's name. I mean, there was some gross negligence. I mean, Bush, you know, it's sad, America has not had a well-informed president since Bill Clinton, who I mostly opposed. I mean, every president since then is like, well, I got my notes. Obama was better than George W. and better than Trump, but I think he was still mostly poorly informed. So anyhow.
What role do you think Trump has in all of this? I mean, I want to get into Trump and Biden and what your thoughts are on them in relation to Afghanistan.
Trump had some good lines in his 2016 presidential campaign. He was bashing trigger-happy Hillary, because Hillary Clinton was a, you know, warmonger, fair charge. I think he talked about ending the endless wars.
Then he hires John Bolton and Elliot Abrams.
Well, you know, I've never said he was perfect. No, so I was, but, you know, part of Trump's problem was, you know, well, actually, I don't know what the problem was. I think he, you know, didn't like to read. And I think he'd rather watch TV and tweet. I mean, he made terrible hiring decisions, you know, to bring in H.R. McMaster and then have him persuade Trump to do a mini surge into Afghanistan, which he announced in August 2017. I was following that speech on Twitter and scoffed at Trump up and down on that. It was a total betrayal. It was a total load of crap. Flip forward a few years, and Trump, I think, recognized the error of his way. He was trying to get out of Afghanistan. And then you had people in Congress rushing to block them. You had Liz Cheney, who is the most beloved Republican of the Washington Post editorial page. And she was instrumental in blocking not only withdrawal from Afghanistan, but even withdrawal from Germany. And it's like, there was such a pro-war bias, and it's sanctified. I mean, in Washington, D.C., being pro-war means you never have to apologize.
You know, it's interesting. I want to get to Biden, but first I just wanted to comment, since you mentioned McMaster. I was just talking to retired Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis today, who was very in favor of the withdrawal and blew the whistle on the surge. And I also talked to Matthew Ho recently, who was a big fan of your latest piece at Scott Horton's Libertarian Institute. But what I find so interesting is that you have these figures like Leon Panetta, you have McMaster, you even have a lot of these Republicans, I think Dan Crenshaw, I think even Trump has said, oh, we may have to go back into Afghanistan because they have our weapons now. And I'm just thinking to myself, you know, we were systemically, you know, at least, this is a nice way of putting it, systemically misled. I think some people would just say straight up lied to. And we know that from the Afghanistan papers. These people don't have a leg to stand on.
Yeah, I agree completely. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction, John Sopko. I sent out a pitch to an editor to talk about how he should be recognized as the hero of the the final years of U.S. in Afghanistan. Never got a response. No, I mean, there's a lot of people who said a lot of stupid things, and Trump included. I mean, I haven't paid much attention to Trump for a while. If Trump was talking about how we need to go back and get the weapons back, it's kind of like, well, you know, have a good trip, dude. It's not worth killing folks to get a bunch of Humvees. It was a fiasco of an exit.
Maybe these people should go in themselves. They could be like a special forces team that goes in.
Absolutely. No, it's frustrating to see. Okay, it's not surprising that people say stupid things, but that the media does not say, well, you know, that was a really stupid thing. Instead, it's like, oh, well, that's interesting. Yeah, well, you know, we got our Humvees back there. It's like, I don't know. There are so many levels of stupidity. And again, there's a hold harmless for warmongers in D.C. It doesn't matter how stupid their idea was. It doesn't matter how many Americans and foreigners got killed by their previous bad ideas. It's like, well, you know, we got to stand up for America and be tough. It's like, I don't know. It's there's not a learning curve, partly because the people who are bleeding aren't making the policy.
I just wanted to ask you about that. When it comes to the media and just this fawning over figures like George W. Bush, just not questioning a lot of these generals, not questioning really anyone that's in the D.C. Establishment. What's the cause of that? Is it just a result of access journalism? I mean, you're a journalist, so I feel like you would have an insight into this.
Okay, well, you know, that's that was your first mistake. You know, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of servility in the media. And it's not just on this issue or that issue. I went to the White House Correspondents' Dinner once, you know, never got invited back. But it was funny to be there and just kind of watching the atmospherics, because there'd be some movie star or some famous person come in the room, and all these journalists would go racing at them like it was a bunch of teenage girls chasing a rock star. And, you know, I was waiting for some of the journalists to start throwing their panties at the famous person. It was undignified. And I was thinking, okay, so here's someone who was in some movies, or here's someone who was, you know, got this award or that award, you know, okay, well, you know, if he comes by, I'll talk to him, but, you know, I'm not going to be fawning. But this is the mindset. Plus, a huge factor is the lack of intellectual curiosity. You know, the journalists, it's funny talking about issues that they write about. They simply, you know, they're like this State Department official. It's like, well, are you, you know, have you checked at how this policy was a disaster the last eight times? No, we have new leadership. No, you know, it's a new administration. These people think they're so smart that the evidence of history does not apply.
And I would just add to that too. I mean, I also think there's an issue with, you know, a lot of these journalists that were on the ground in Iraq and Afghanistan, I mean, it has to be noted, they're embedded journalists most of the time. Yeah, so in a way, I mean, they have a stake in the empire.
Well, yeah, there are some journalists that have done some excellent work and have called out the lies and cover-ups. There was some very good work on the torture stuff. By the torture stuff in Afghanistan, the Bagram Air Force Base, or there was a CIA secret site close to that Air Force base where they did torture year after year and killed a lot of innocent people.
There was also Michael Hastings was calling out the generals before he passed away. He was great.
Hastings did great work. He was very courageous and very effective. And he was also good at getting these people to talk and just keep on talking. And eventually they provided enough rope to take them down. So, you know, there was a, I think it was Dan Rather, who said around 2007 or 2008, that there was fear in the newsrooms in America, fear of the Patriot Police, fear of, a government condemning them. I mean, shit, I've had government officials contact places I've written for, and they've been urged not to publish me. So, and this probably happened a hell of a lot more than I realized. And, you know, because there's a lot of doors that have closed over the years. Sometimes they've reopened, but, you know, I mean, this is, you know, you got to expect this when you're not running with the herd. So
I was going to add to that, too. I mean, ultimately, I think if people care about domestic policy and what is happening in the U.S., they have to care about foreign policy, too, because, you know, people are worried about, for instance, police brutality and the militarization of the police in this country. Well, that's, you know, the militarization of the police. I think there's a direct line between that and the war state and its growth with the war on terror. I think there's a connection between the loss of civil liberties and the war on terror.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's almost a synonym as far as the war on terror and the loss of civil liberties, because there was so much deference given to the FBI. You know, folks forget after 9/11, the FBI rounded up 1,200 people, and the FBI had this form that they'd use the federal judges. Well, this is part of a matrix complex. Christ, I'm not getting the exact word, but there was this, you know, they had this formula why all these arrests had to be secret. And a federal judge finally said, look, he had a great line, which I'm not recalling. I'm turning to Biden here. So, but the FBI went vastly further than it had been allowed to go further. All these secret arrests, all these entrapment operations, and this stuff is still going on. So, I mean, you know, how long is it going to be until we know what the FBI role was on January 6th? You had a week or two ago, you had the Reuters story that had the FBI leaks that were kind of basically puncturing the balloon as far as a vast, well, that's a different story. So, anyway.
Well, I was even going to say, even before January 6th, one of the things I cover on this show a lot is 9/11, and now there's a civil suit against Saudi Arabia for potential Saudi involvement. And I think, you know, with 9/11, we never really looked into, and I'm not talking about any truther stuff here, but we never talked about the intel failures and why didn't heads roll that this happened in our country. There was no real accountability, and I think that's the same with January 6th and other events.
Yeah, I mean, that was something which I wrote about in Terrorism and Tyranny back in 2003. There were a shitload of warnings that came in. And it's interesting, there was a bipartisan or joint congressional investigation that actually came out late 2002, early 2003. They found a lot of good dirt. I mean, there was Senator Graham from Florida was a point person on this. Senator from Alabama, who's on the take for home loans.
This is where the famous 28 pages came from.
Yes. Yeah. And this is where that came out, which Obama finally partially disclosed, I guess, in 2016. If that had come out at the time, it would have been far more difficult for the Bush administration to paint Iraq as the culprit for 9/11, which was always bullshit. But it's funny how the media played that, because you had this joint congressional report by very respected senators that got a little bit of attention. And then you got the 9/11 commission that were just certified bootleggers and chose to bury the evidence and was just kind of like rally around the government. And well, you know, we boost the budget and hire more TSA agents. I mean, it was a complete, sellout to the powers that be. I mean, you know, they finally did an interview with Bush, but there's no transcript. And, and they didn't have their lawyers there with them to ask real questions. So it was a sham. But the media loved the 9/11 Commission. The media still talks about Keene and Hamilton like they're, visionaries and statesmen. But I think it was Hamilton who was actually doing speeches for MEK, which is an Iranian terrorist group. There were a lot of big wigs, Washington players, who got paid $30,000 or around that to make these brief speeches to this terrorist group. And then the terrorist group would say, see, we've been endorsed by these top U.S. government officials. Obama eventually caved on that and ended the classification of terrorism. But yeah.
I was going to say what's really fascinating to me about all of this is people will talk about leaving Afghanistan. We've lost all credibility and, you know, they'll say things like that. And yeah, here's the thing. When people talk about women's rights and girls' rights in Afghanistan, you know, I care about that myself, but I don't know how anyone can take seriously these claims. I mean, you mentioned the whole thing with Karzai, and not only that, but you know, there was that Alaska summit with China, where China basically said, well, look in your own backyard before you criticize us. And people will say, oh, that's whataboutism. And I'll say, you know, we can say that's whataboutism and it's deflection, but China can't make that deflection without us having allies like Saudi Arabia and Turkey that commit massive human rights violations. Yep. There's a reason we can't be taken seriously at times.
I agree. And it's just, you know, something as blunt as Syria right now. The U.S. is helping strangle that economy. We have sanctions on Syria. And I would love to know how many members of Congress, if they were caught on videotape, put on the spot, how many members could explain why do we have sanctions, economic sanctions on the Syrian people? I mean, there's no good reason for that. I mean, you know, heading back a decade, you're like, well, you know, we've got to topple Assad. What the hell would that do? Well, first of all, it failed. You got a lot of innocent Syrians killed. You spurred a much worse civil war that you dragged that out. And you're basically financing groups that were on par or allied with Al-Qaeda. But it's okay because the government's doing it.
Well, it's like you look at the sanctions in Iran. What has that done? That has only emboldened nationalist sentiments. And I mean, even, you know, I will talk to libertarians about this sometimes, and I think people are surprised that most of the libertarians I know don't even like the sanctions on places like Venezuela or Cuba.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it'd be great to drop all those sanctions. I mean, there's, you know, many governments are following horrible economic policies, but it'd be good if they did not have the U.S. as a scapegoat for their failed policies. But you know, it's just, but it's, you know, looking at Syria, where did U.S. citizens get the right to try to put an economic stranglehold on a foreign people that had done no wrong to us and are no threat? I mean, it's not like Syria has a nuclear weapons program or is alleged to have a nuclear weapons program. Let me clarify. So it's just, yeah, there is. I have to say, though, that I did a book called Bush Betrayal. It got translated into Arabic.
And that was the first book I read of yours. And I read it very young. I was in my teens, like maybe 16 or so, and I loved it.
Great. Well, thank you. Well, it didn't get much play here in America, but it got translated into Arabic. And about the most positive book review, which I saw for that book, happened in Syria just after the Israelis had bombed a Syria supposed weapons plant. And it's like, you know, If I got a positive book review every time there was a foreign bombing, damn, I'd be doing pretty well.
So there's just two more things I wanted to cover. I know I've kept you a little bit long here.
No, it's fine.
So the first thing before we start closing out is Biden. How should we think about Biden in relation to the Afghanistan withdrawal? Because as I was telling you before we started recording, I think on one hand, there are criticisms to be made of how the exit was carried out. On the other hand, you know, I think the media has piled on in a way that I'm very uncomfortable with.
Yeah, well, both things can be true. I mean, I'm glad that Biden did not flinch and extend the U.S. occupation. I think that the way he did the exit was a fiasco. I think he's still lying about it. I don't know. It was, you know, watching his speech this afternoon at the White House. It's interesting. It seemed like his diction was much better than usual, but that made it easier to recognize what the words were, and they were pretty appalling. It's funny. He had, like, towards the very end of the speech, he had some very good lines about the cost of the war, the number of veteran suicides, but he had pounded the audience into submission with 20 minutes of doggerel before that. And all this stuff, absolving himself, and it's, you know, and it was the greatest airlift in history. And it's like, it's, I don't think Biden is cordial as far as being able to learn anything about the real problems of U.S. foreign policy. He's shown that in his statements after the Afghan problems started with the Afghan withdrawal. There's a swagger there. He seems, you know, he's mentally limited at this point. And when he does take questions, it's like, oh, my God. So, I mean, Trump had a lot of limits as well. So I'm glad the U.S. pulled out. I think Biden doing these endless number of bad speeches to congratulate himself, I think that's a fiasco.
One thing people I noticed, especially people on the sort of right wing end of the political spectrum, were very angry about was when we had the airport attack, you know, we had generals coming out saying we're working with or cooperating with the Taliban to make sure another of these attacks doesn't happen while the evacuation is occurring. And to be honest, I don't know how you feel about this, but I feel like that was sort of necessary. Sometimes you have to cooperate with governments that you really don't like. And we may have to do that going forward in a lot of ways.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, there's, you know, there's a whole lot of things that Biden deserves harsh criticism for as far as how this was covered out. There's also been criticism that's just like, you know, give me a freaking break. It's like, you know, we needed to get the hell out of there. And it was, and once we pulled out, it's not going to be pretty, but it wasn't pretty when we were there. So, but it's, you know, it goes back to a saying of Henry Adams, historian Henry Adams. He said, politics is a systematic organization of hatreds. And I think we're seeing that in foreign policy fights. You know, there are unfair criticisms that Biden is getting at this point, but that doesn't make Biden an honest man.
The thing we always get, I assume you've gotten this too, is, you know, people always say, oh, you claim that you're for realism and restraint in foreign policy, but really you're just a dirty isolationist. And I think we're the opposite of isolationists. To me, the real isolationists, Trita Parsi said this to me recently, the real isolationists are the people who the first thing they want to do is drop bombs and have sanctions and economic warfare, because they're not even into diplomatic engagement. Once you don't have diplomatic engagement, what's left? You know, I mean, it's insane. We live in bizarro world.
Well, it goes back to 9/11, shortly thereafter. George Bush was talking about U.S. military force like it was a moral curative, like it was like, you know, this it's a question of good versus evil. And the U.S. military, I think he almost came out and said that it was like the ultimate force for the good. And when you start thinking of bombs and bullets and, you know, drone attacks as the triumph of good over evil, then you're going to think, well, if we have more of them, then we'll vanquish even more evil. But it goes back to that woman on the hike. She was not willing to consider what were the facts on the ground as far as the lives of the foreigners and the lives of the American soldiers. And there's a smugness and there's a sense of superiority. And it's like, you know, these are folks who won't learn because, and as you mentioned earlier, these folks won't learn because they aren't doing the bleeding. And a lot of them have gotten very rich and very famous. I think didn't the Washington Post Outlook section this past week have a three entire page by Robert Kagan, I think.
Oh my God. If they did, I missed that. But yeah, my God, every 6 months or so, I will read a new Robert Kagan article. It seems like he writes like two articles a year, and they're all the same. They're all, you need to die for the empire. My kids don't, but you do, you stupid plebs. And he is one of the most aggravating writers out there.
Well, there's a long list. But again, it's interesting. You have all these warmongers and none of them, and they're still very prominent. I mean, it was a clear lesson. I think Justin Raimondo wrote about this. After 9/11, you had all these warmongers that were in favor of invading Iraq and elsewhere, and they basically became more famous and richer, whereas people who opposed the war were kind of pushed in the shadows.
Do you think that's changing a bit, though, now? Because for me, I'm noticing Stephen Wertheim and Andrew Bacevich have been given space to write op-eds in places like the New York Times. I think the Quincy Institute, which I'm really supportive of, is starting to make a lot of inroads. I think people are taking them more seriously. Do you think that Biden's withdrawal, it may have opened up a real debate in foreign policy about restraint and war?
Maybe, but I mean, you know, the folks, the folks who have the power in DC really don't give a shit about ideas or about freedom or about peace. And it's just, you know, it might come down to the campaign contributions, the promises of votes. If you look at DC think tanks, Ben Freeman's done some great stuff on this. All the foreign money pouring in there, especially from the Gulf states, it is so corrupting. And yet Brookings is still treated like, well, you know, they're very dignified. It's like, you know, where is their money coming from? It's like, oh, and it's, you know, I'm not saying think tanks need to be foreign, registered as foreign agents, but when there's so much cash coming in, and, you know, I was, had the bad luck to hear something on NPR a few days ago, and they were, you know, and we have two experts. I think they were both from Middle East institutes that are, let's say that their funding is far from objective. And it's like, and you're treating these folks like they're, founts of wisdom. But, you know, there's people in D.C. are bought, intellectuals are bought. This is one of the real lessons from the Afghanistan war, is not to trust Washington intellectuals, because they sold out en masse. You had all these people who got rich being consultants for democracy promotion. It was always a sham. But, you know, they've still got their mansion in Great Falls.
Last thing I wanted to cover was you wrote a really great piece. Matthew Ho told me about it, and that's why I had to get you on the show. Libertarian Institute, that's Scott Horton's great website. You've written Afghanistan and the Sham of Democracy Promotion. And I just want to say, you know, for me, the big sham is we were talking about building Afghanistan. We're going to build Afghanistan. You know, I felt like we didn't build Afghanistan. What we built was Virginia and all the weapons contractors there.
Yeah, very much. The last lines of that piece was the collapse of the Afghan government settled any doubts about whether intellectuals are some of Washington's biggest con artists. Americans need to recognize, take lessons from the endless lies that Washington told about Afghan democracy, and are the same government officials telling the same kind of lies about U.S. democracy.
And what for you is the most important thing to note when we say Afghanistan and the sham of democracy promotion? I mean, people say, oh, that's strong words. You're calling it a complete sham. What do you have to say to the naysayers?
Read the damn Inspector General report from February this year that walked through, I think it was over 200 pages, and it had all the details of all the fraud that had been systemic going back at least 15 years, and how each election was even more rigged, all these phantom voters. One thing that fascinated me is that the president of Afghanistan suddenly announced in 2019 that the next election had to be done with computer voting, and kind of implying, well, that's going to make it honest. It didn't. It was just a new way to steal votes. But that would never happen here because there's libel lawsuits.
So in closing, if there's anything that you would want my listeners to get out of this conversation, what would it be?
Some good laughs. I mean, it's things are really ugly in politics and in foreign policy at this point. It's really great that you're educating folks, that you're bringing folks with ideas that others might not have heard from your regular viewers might not have heard, like me and Karen Kwiatkowski. Just keep fighting for peace, and maybe one day we'll be able to get a leash on all these damn rascals.
All I'm going to add to that is I do think we need to get some laughs out of these things, because, you know, it is a tragic comedy in many ways.
It is. It's just too bad that we're locked into a train that's kind of going over the bridge.
So how can my listeners keep up with your work, Jim?
Website is jimbovard.com. My articles and media stuff, I usually post on a blog there. I write for a bunch of different places. Counterpunch, Libertarian Institute, USA Today sometimes, so American Conservative. So I survive.
Thank you again, Jim Bovard, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with the Libertarian Gadfly. I love saying that. Jim Bovard. As always, if you can, please, please, please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. Should be having some new exclusive bonus content out in the next week. So look forward to that. I have an interview coming out with These Long Wars, a blogger who you may remember from his collaborations with Radio War Nerd and The Michael Brooks Show. You'll be able to access that at the $5 tier and above on my Patreon page, and you can even support me at the lowest tier of just $1, one measly dollar to keep this program going. I need all the help I can get, folks. Oh, and by the way, there's also the $10 and $15 tiers. And at those tiers, you get a producer's credit shout-out on each and every edition of the program, which leads us to producer's credit shout-outs to Mark, Arlen, Spartacus, Ed, Gratz, James, Jamie, Mickey, Brian, The War Nerd, Emilia, Chase, Orc, Black Tuna, Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Martin, Ryan S., and Jeffrey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers. And you can do that at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views. With Parallax Views. To Parallax Views. With Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it. Just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight. With no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.